The whole thing with her having the food, June just constantly eating, mm-hmm. it's just because that's just part of Esther's like stage persona that we wanted to capture. And this is kind of like a stoner movie where the lead character doesn't smoke or drink. And if we were inspired by movies like The Big Lebowski, where he's always got a joint, then she's always munching on something.
Hello, and welcome back to The Director's Cut, brought to you by the Directors Guild of America. In this episode, growing pains and neighborhood crime dominate a young woman's life in director Nicholas Goosen's comedy, Drugstore June. The film tells the story of June, a wannabe influencer whose life grows increasingly complicated as she juggles personal and interpersonal problems. Taking matters into her own hands, June heads out to get over her ex, solve a crime, and become more of an adult. In addition to Drugstore June, Goosen's other directorial credits include the feature films The Shortcut and Grandma's Boy, and episodes of the series Typical Rick, Six Guys, One Car, and Comedians Crashing Couches. Following a screening of the film at the DGA Theater in Los Angeles, Goosen spoke with director Sammy Cohen about filming Drugstore June. Listen on for their spoiler-filled conversation.
Hi, guys. How we doing?
Good to like see you. Sunday night, DGA comedy fans.
This I love cool. this. The real ones, you know?
Very cool. Thanks for being here, guys.
So let's get right into it because I'm really excited to chat with you about this movie. I was lucky enough to see it twice now.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
I'm so excited. So I guess the first thing I want to talk about is like really just like how it came to be, how you and Esther wrote the script together. Mm-hmm. So yeah, what was the sort of like origin story? How did this come about? How did you two find each other in this?
Yeah, it was back in 2012 when I first saw Esther on a podcast with the late great comedian Brody Stevens. On a show called Broad and Esther, and I was just instantly kind of mesmerized by this little impish girl going up against this big athlete comedian. It turned out that we actually had the same manager, and he, after I prodded him, he set us up on a meeting over burgers, which is appropriate. That's as one does.
Incredible.
Yeah, yeah. So, and we became fast friends over those burgers, and. Shortly thereafter, we started working together a lot at Comedy Central, where I was doing a lot of projects at the time. And I was casting her in every little thing that I was doing over there until we started developing a web series back when those were still a thing for a network that eventually folded their web series division. And there were some of the things from the movie in that web series, like the pharmacy specifically, her working there, Bobby Lee being her boss, Brandon Wardell being her brother, who I don't know if this is a spoiler free podcast. Brandon Wardell, who you know what he does, and eventually we were like, you know what, let's turn this into a feature film, and that is kind of the beginnings of how the movie came to be.
Oh, that's so fun. And yeah, I was going to ask you this later, but there, you know, you come from a comedy background, as does Esther, and it was really fun. I love casting stand-ups in my work, and that's such a fun, I love hearing that you were already working with, you know, some of these people.
Yeah.
But yeah, how did that, like, was that always the plan? How does that work into, like, your filmmaking in general as a director?
Well, as you know, having worked with Happy Madison yourself, that just, it seems like second nature having come up under the Sandler team and his way of doing things. Yeah, because my first film, Grandma's Boy, was very much in the kind of the same vein in a large ensemble, a lot of cameos, a lot of our friends. And certainly, like I said, from the beginning, we knew that we wanted Bobby Lee, who's a mutual friend of Esther and I's, to play her boss, and Brandon Wardell, who we both know, to play her brother. On a movie like this, it was shot on a very, very small budget in a very short amount of time. Pretty much everybody in the movie is like a personal friend who we had to basically reach out to personally. most of the time had to go around their agents who wouldn't even return our emails because of the low budget that we were offering. So yeah, it kind of was always, especially working with Bill Burr's company on this one, All Things Comedy. Anybody that I didn't know or Esther didn't know, Jordan Elner and Mike Bertolina, Al Madrigal, Bill Burr, obviously, they had somebody to kind of fill in to introduce us to. And it's pretty much how it worked.
That's awesome. Yeah. I mean, you guys really did an incredible job casting, even seeing like Steph Tolev, who plays the bartender, like just some real heavy hitters in every single scene. It was really quite fun. I'm going to shift to the music. I love, love, love the music in this film. I think like kicking it off with It's a Song by the Dixie Cups, I think.
Yes.
But I mean, in general, like there's something very nostalgic to the, you know, the music as a whole, but I'm kind of curious, like your process, are any of those songs in your head before you write? Did any songs you want actually make the final cut?
You know, I'm always reluctant to put, even when I see as a non-writer, this, in this instance, I did write the script, but even as a just a director reading somebody else's script, I'm always kind of bumped by when there's a specific song in there, unless it's really well used. So no, I actually deliberately didn't put any of the songs in the script, except for there was a brief scene at the end of the bar sequence where June was supposed to kind of get up and sing karaoke. So we did write in a song that she would sing there, but that was the extent of it. So it wasn't until editorial. And I will say there was one song that I kind of had in mind going into the shoot, which was the title sequence song by The Voids, Julian Casablancas, because I kind of knew I was going to call him and ask him for a favor for his music because I'd worked with him on some music videos. I had basically done those for nothing. So I was calling in my favor on this one. So that opening title sequence was designed to that song.
That's a good favor to call in. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. The rest were just many of the other artists though on the soundtrack were also friends who I reached out to up and down the line. Even a couple of the guys from Julian's band gave me some of their individual songs. And then also a lot of others were just, I would just DM people on Instagram. It was a lot of begging, basically. It was just tons of begging. Lots of, you got to get good at that if you're going to make some indie movies.
Indie filmmaking. Yeah. We love it.
Yeah. Beg, beg, beg.
So there's something I think like even music included, there's something very like nostalgic about this film. Like for me watching it, it felt like it pays homage to a lot of these like 90s, you know, indie classics that I don't know, I love. But I think talk a little bit about, you know, the sonic footprint, but also like the production design, the wardrobe, like there was something really quite nostalgic. What were your influences?
That was absolutely intentional. All of our references were basically 80s movies, some 90s movies. Even when you bring up the music and you bring up the Dixie Cups, the Dixie Cups, that's produced by Phil Spector. And one of the movies that inspired Drugstore June was Adventures in Babysitting, which also opens up with a Phil Spector song. And Then He Kissed Me, which is, you know, I love Elizabeth Shue running around her bedroom, getting dressed, ready for the big date that doesn't happen. So it's kind of, it's, you know, she was kind of scorned by her boyfriend and that kind of sets the whole plot in motion. So you can kind of see where some of that inspiration came from. Mm-hmm. You know, even a movie like Ferris Bueller's Day Off was a big inspiration to us. And we wanted, you know, because movies like that, they were colorful, but they still look cinematic, you know. You're not getting a lot of that in modern day filmmaking. It feels like a lot of, you know, desaturated comedies these days. And Licorice Pizza was another one that was an inspiration to us, which obviously that's kind of also a movie that's hearkening back to an older time, more specifically. But yeah, everything, it was, even not showing the phone was like trying to make it feel a little bit more timeless in a way, you know, by not showing the phone screen and not showing specific social media apps or stuff that'll just age too quickly.
I was gonna ask you that, and you answered perfectly.
The phone thing too was something that people were freaking out about, because they were like, "Wait, really? This movie's about a social media influencer. She's on her phone like the whole movie, and you're never gonna show the phone screen. You're never gonna show these." People were, they were questioning me on that one. But having worked on a movie where I helped out on a Sandler movie where there was I had to shoot just like a ton of phone inserts. I swore, I was like, I'm not going to let this movie get stuck in the time suck of shooting phone screens. So we only did that one deliberate joke when she's writing the suspects and then does the little Shining bit.
Yeah, I thought it was, you know, I think skewering the influencer culture is it's such a fun, like, I think interesting topic that we're all quite, you know, obsessed with because we have to be and we live on these things. But I haven't seen it done quite that way. And I thought it was actually really effective to see only, you know, the real life.
Well, it just looks, I mean, you know, it's just looks so ridiculous, you know, and this is what we see in real life. So it just felt like it's kind of funny just to kind of hold on that in a movie too. And also the thought was, we're looking at our phones all day as it is. Why, like, am I really going to make you look at a phone in a movie too? Like, let's just give ourselves just a brief moment of not looking at a phone screen. Look at a different screen, the movie screen.
Exactly. We're here to look at movie screens. Yeah. There we go.
Like this one. This is a badass movie screen right here.
Okay. I have to talk about the gummy bear for just a moment. I thought it was really, really well done. Was that all VFX, or was that something practical and then you modified it in VFX?
It was a practical gummy bear. A woman made it for us, I believe, in North Carolina for like $150 a pop. They were heavy. They were real. I mean, it was an actual edible gummy bear. I thought it would be a lot easier to find than it was. But no, we had a couple of various sized bears. A smaller one for her to give birth to, and then the toddler bear, and then we had a helmet type of thing fabricated for somebody to wear for the graduate gummy. It was on that day when we were shooting the gummy bear stuff. That was when everybody on set just kind of looked at each other like, "What is this real? Is this a real movie? What are we doing right now?" It was very surreal. But yeah, a great pretend VFX who actually worked on Everything Everywhere All at Once did the gummy bear effects. So we had like this great visual effects team, and we were asking them to animate a gummy bear.
If we don't get to grow up and make gummy bears for a living, what are we doing?
Yes. You know? No sponsorship from Haribo, which was really bummed me out because of one of my faves, obviously.
A missed opportunity,
yeah,
but you know.
It sucked.
The cast is so much fun. I really like the cast is incredible. And outside of just the stand-ups, who I was really delighted to see all of those familiar faces, and talented folks, talk to me about just your casting process, you know, like Beverly D'Angelo, just some really incredible, you know, people. Anyone, did you write any of the parts for anyone?
Well, like Bobby and Brandon and Esther, there was, other parts, like say the girl at the weed store, so there's Jenny, the girl working the register. We're thinking about who could play that part, and I go, oh, well, what about Bad Baby? She could be that she kind of fits into the weed milieu. So once she agrees to do it, that's when we punch it up for more of her voice. So much so that when I kind of rehearsed it for her before we shot, she was like, damn, man, this already sound like me. I don't even got to do nothing. So she was like, it was kind of like that. And then Beverly D'Angelo, that was Robert Schwartzman introduced her to us from Utopia. He had worked with her before. And I mean, how lucky are we? I mean, Esther and I were just so excited when he brought that up. We were like, is that really a possibility? Yes, please. And just as soon as she read the script and hopped on board, she just had all these great ideas. It was amazing. It was a big difference working with Beverly D'Angelo and James Remar than all the stand-up comedians. It was a little different. She actually reads the whole thing and cares about all the parts and the whole story. Comedians tend to focus just on their own lines. And James Remar, I actually had met through one of my dad's old boxing compatriots, Steve Petromali, who has a delicious pop-up in Venice that he does on Fridays. And James Remar is one of his best friends. And I met him there. And as soon as I saw him arguing with Steve and kvetching over the price, I was like, oh man, he might be a really good June dad. And he didn't really quite believe me when I brought it up to him, but I was just so happy that he agreed to do it.
He's so fun. I mean, like, I love, you know, I love him in Dexter. I love him in so many things, but yeah. Like to see him in this role, he's so funny. It was like the family unit as a whole, I thought it worked so well. And it was really fun. I even watching the second time through, I wanted to know, you wrote the film again with Esther, but, with stand-ups or otherwise, like, did you guys play on set, improvise anything, were there any happy accidents? What was that like?
Yeah. I would say it's 90% scripted. I would say it's only about 10% improvised. People are, they often ask, but we shot the movie in just 19 days. There was not a lot of time to improvise, you know. Day one, you kind of had to just set the tone too. I mean, Nick Rutherford, he's a great writer himself. He plays Max, you know, one of the stick-up guys with Owen there, Danny Griffin. And he had just some great ideas right away. And that, and we actually had to shoot the flop house scene first day. And, you know, he wanted to just do bits where he was just like throwing a bottle that he might drop. And it's like, no, we can't track anything through the air. Nothing can be dropped and reset. You basically can't do anything physical. You certainly can't improvise that way. Yeah. A little bit with a line or here, a line or two here or there, but, yeah, it was just little add-ons mostly, because we just were so pressed for time that we needed just them to nail the script, which we felt pretty strongly about, and everybody did. So, but certainly, yeah, there is improv in there, but not as much as people think.
Did the stand-ups improvise?
Oh God. Yeah, no, that there's no, actually. So, I mean, believe it or not, like even, I don't think he would mind me saying, but Bill Burr, he kind of was like, I don't feel like when I come there tomorrow, I don't feel like improvising. But then of course we get there, we start shooting, and next thing you know, he and Esther are improvising, and some of the best stuff is in that scene. You know, the whole plastic surgery bit was just something that they just came up with right then and there, as an evolution of the scene. So, some people, even when they say they don't want to improvise, they end up doing it, and then vice versa. A lot of people would think Bobby Lee would be a big improv guy. No, we just had to get him just to say the lines.
I mean, you guys did an incredible job. I think writing too, like you even pointed it out. But yeah, writing to these people's voices, and it felt like very natural in the best way. Like, you know, I think the script alone felt really natural and really, it was really funny.
Thank you. Yeah. I mean, it helped that we had Esther to kind of ground every scene, you know, so it was like you could never stray too far away from what the tone had to be, because she's in every scene and you're always with her. So she was kind of our, you know, guiding light, our North Star, tonally. And it was really cool to direct a movie that I wrote for the first time, which it was cool to, basically the only person who could kind of tell me I was wrong about something was Esther. And she rarely did.
And you also edited the movie as well. So like writing, directing, editing, and to me, editing is so much writing again in post. Talk to me a little bit about the process of writing through editing, because you really have your hands on it the whole time. And what's that kind of like for you? And do you involve people in the edit to sort of, do you need to take time away to have a fresh set of
I wish... You know, again, I'm used to the happy, I came up through Happy Madison and in the Sandler camp, and there's a lot of people around that editing room, and Adam keeps it crowded because it's just so much more fun doing it that way. It's a lot of work. It's a lot of long hours, as you know, and it's fun. With a comedy, it's just so much easier to just be like, is that funny? And just to have somebody there to like check with, I think it's trickier than other genres in that way. But no, I actually had to edit this completely alone, basically, out of my house in Venice, on a Mac Mini on Adobe Premiere with no AEs. I had to do all the music editing. As far as like writing through the edit, I don't feel like it didn't really change dramatically. There was no like structural changes. It worked like the way, because that's the thing. I wrote it as an editor kind of, you know, so in the writing, I was thinking about the edit. So it all kind of lined up. All we had to do was kind of take stuff out or tighten things, you know?
What, yeah. Any scenes that you had to lose that, yeah, I don't know, fun scenes that didn't make the cut?
Really just one scene entirely. And that was just an early scene with Jonathan, the brother. It was kind of in that first 15 minutes and there was pressure to get to the robbery a little bit quicker. I feel like, it would have been nice to have one more scene with Brandon because I just think he's so funny, but I guess I don't miss it. That was the only scene that we lost. And then just a little chunk at the end of the bar sequence when she was supposed to get up and do a big karaoke performance, which we did shoot a couple takes of. We were really up against it. It was our last day of shooting. There was extras issues, and also we didn't get the song that we really wanted her to sing, which was Stand By Your Man by Tammy Wynette. It was just not in the cards because it was too expensive. We ended up having to get like a Paula Abdul song that Esther just wasn't vibing with it in the way that we needed her to. And we couldn't hide it with any extras because we couldn't create a crowd to shoot through because we didn't have anybody. So we basically just said, yeah, this isn't working. Let's move on.
What were some of your favorite scenes to shoot? What were some of the kind of favorites?
Which, by the way, the karaoke thing was again influenced. It was inspired by Adventures in Babysitting when she gets up and sings the Babysitting Blues. Shout out Chris Columbus. We love him. Favorite scenes to shoot? Probably the ones where Esther's just like laying in a bed because it was just she's just sitting there as a stationary object. And I just had to move the kind of camera around her. And that was fun because we were in a real house. We shot in a real house in Torrance for a week. And, you know, I was like sitting on a couch in the living room directing from one. That was probably the most comfortable we were the whole shoot.
We love being cozy when we're directing.
In a real house in Torrance.
It's pretty incredible.
Yeah.
I have to ask, who has the sugar addiction?
Well,
in your life,
I think Esther is a huge dessert person. If anybody knows anything about Esther, she's very food forward. She's very food centric. You know, the whole thing with her having the food June just constantly eating is just because that's just part of Esther's like stage persona that we wanted to capture. And this is kind of like a stoner movie where the lead character doesn't smoke or drink. And if we were inspired by movies like The Big Lebowski, where he's always got a joint, then she's always munching on something in a way. I'm the sugar addict, basically. Sure, I'm the guy, I'm the gummy head. But yeah, she's more of like a cookie cake person. So yep. Equal.
Maybe. My white Russians are cupcakes also. Yeah. So I get it. I get it.
I love those, yeah.
I think we started to talk about independent filmmaking and these indie films, they're really hard to get up off the ground and make. But tell me a little bit like about how, you know, you, I remind me again, when you wrote this,
we turned in the script, early 2020, I think February, 2020.
And then, yeah, I guess what was it like sort of like getting this up and running and off the ground? And what's that been like as an indie filmmaker?
It was a pain. It was a pain. I thought it was going to happen a lot quicker, considering that we had really cool companies like Utopia and Bill Burr's company involved, especially with such a heavy hitter like Bill. You'd think that you could get a low budget comedy off the ground a little bit easier, but no, we got passes from every studio in town, basically. We eventually had to raise the money from a few different people. Thank you to Shout Studios for eventually coming in for the largest amount and helping us distribute the movie. That was really, really hard raising the money. That was the probably the hardest part and the most excruciating part is just waiting around because you really have no control over that. I learned a lot about financing. Basically that I would like to make studio movies. No, just kidding. No, I'll make any movie still, but just a little bit more money than this.
And then yes. I know you said 19 days of shooting, which is insanely impressive. The movie looks incredible. You guys did such a good job. And 19 days is just, it's a really...
We had a tremendous crew, starting with some of our DGA brethren. Kristen Plausha was our UPM who I worked with on Hustle, with Sandler, and I, you know, that's like $100 million movie shot all over multiple countries, cities, all over. And she agreed to do our little one. Well, wait, I don't want to say a budget number yet until we make our licensing deal. She agreed to do our little tiny movie, which I was surprised about. I was so happy. Pablo Gambetta, first AD who just won a DJ award for, ADing the Bear. Mm-hmm. He was a referral to me from, my old friend, Adam Druxman, who AD'd Grandma's Boy and Paul Thomas Anderson's early films. Sherry Kauk was the DP on this movie, who it was my first time working with her. This is basically her first movie.
Yeah.
Wow, she was badass. Her along with Jen McLaren, our production designer, Allison Calhoun, our costume designer. I mean, these were all people I've worked with for the first time. Which was, it was a bit nerve wracking, but it was also very gratifying to be able to just kind of step into a movie, work with mostly all new people, mostly, behind the camera and, you know, come together and make something what we think is cool anyway. But yeah, to do it in 19 days, it took a lot. It was a lot of prep. You know, I kind of had to be doing, I had to be scouting locations on my own, driving around LA. Thank God we shot it in LA. Once upon a time, it was supposed to be shot in New Jersey. Oh. It came back to LA where I'm born and raised here. So I know every nook and cranny kind of. My uncle was a location manager. The first time I was in this theater was when my uncle Mike Neal brought me here to see Heat. And when it first released, I was blown away. So it's pretty surreal to see my movie playing here tonight. But yeah, I had to go find the pharmacy before we even had a location manager.
Were you guys all on location or any stage work?
It's completely practical. It's all location. I mean, the stage we were on was just another, like one of these houses and I've some off of a mountain somewhere. They had a spaceship in the parking lot. That's all I remember. some crazy place deep in the valley where there was all these like rooms that you could kind of dress up. Because the standing sets barely exist anymore. There used to be kind of a thing like where you could go to these, but they're just in such disrepair now. But anyway, we found one. That was the closest thing to a stage. But no, everything else was practical. The pharmacies, actually, the pharmacy was operating while we were shooting. We were giving people their prescriptions out of the back door while I'm like in my little tiny video village in the broom closet. Everything had to be done on a mic because also they were all that medication you see in the background is all real. That part wasn't dressed because they were like, okay, yeah, you can shoot here, but these are all real drugs. And like, you can't, this is,
like,
people need their medicine.
Exactly what we want. Yeah.
So actually while Bobby's in the back there, there's actually a couple of pharmacists just sitting underneath. You can't see them off camera, just waiting to fill prescriptions as people came to the back door.
That's amazing.
Deep Long Beach. Yeah, I was in deep, little kooky neighborhood in Long Beach. Shout out Vermilion's Pharmacy. Thank you for letting us shoot there.
That's so fun. Yeah, in the best way. Long Beach makes sense. I mean this in the best way. I grew up in LA too, in the Valley. And I was like, this just feels like, again, very nostalgic, but like you get that in the Valley and it feels like in the best way, a Valley movie.
I guess it should because I'm from the Valley, so that it makes sense that that rubs off. And of course, it was literally shot here. Now it's supposed to be the Midwest, technically. And we kind of went for any town USA. But when you see the receipt, you know, when there are details that have to be given, it's, we say it's Illinois. But yeah, I mean, it was all shot in LA, so.
It's great.
We avoided all the palm trees, though. So hopefully.
Which is very hard to do.
It was tricky. It was tricky.
I wanted to ask you too, I think like knowing again, like Grandma's Boy as well, credits, graphics, title sequences. I think like you're someone who, it seems like you take a lot of care and consideration as you're like, you know, fabricating and thinking about that stuff. Yeah. Just talk about that process. And was that, did you have a heavy hand in that? Who are you working with? Where did that inspiration kind of come from aesthetically?
Yeah. I hate when it's an afterthought, you know? So having done Grandma's Boy and having those turn out so cool and doing the Galaga thing, it's just, we were just doing anything that we could just to make the movie feel a little bit bigger. And thank you to Slice, Slice Collective, who did the front and end titles. It was just a means to send people out of the theater feeling good It was just simple as that. Just to make it look cool. I mean, it's always boring when you see the last image then just dissolve to just simple white on black credits, you know, that you can tell were just, you know, put on in the last second in the finish or something. You see that on indie movies a lot, so.
Yeah, and I think, again, in like the best way, it's sort of like page homage to these other, like, I think like movies that have, you know, these very cool title sequences that help the film as a whole feel cohesive and, right. Yeah, not just, like you said, an afterthought. I thought it was, it's really fun through and through.
Thank you.
I know we have to wrap up, but any fun fact you can throw at us, like anything we don't know about Drugstore June, any fun IMDb fact for us?
Fun fact.
Fun fact or memory.
Fun fact or memory. Well, we did shoot, fun fact. The weed store is a place called Puffers on Victory Boulevard. And right next door to it is a place called Socorro's No. 1. Delicious Mexican food. I highly recommend it. Get the beef mojajete No. 2. We ate there constantly. We were in that area. That was actually, that might have been some of the most fun times on set was going to lunch at Socorro's.
Plug for Socorro's. We love it. Yeah. All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you, guys. Thank you for snaking around. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to another DGA Q&A. The Director's Cut is available wherever you listen to podcasts. And please share, subscribe, rate, and review. We'd love to hear your feedback, and you can help fellow film buffs find the show. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time. This podcast is produced by the Directors Guild of America.